families naturally need support from culture. That you can't just have a mom and a dad who are great parents and that's enough to raise kids. The nuclear family is the most important thing. It's necessary. It's not sufficient. And so that's where I came up with the idea of writing a book about how our culture is family unfriendly.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Marlo Slayback. And today, Tim Carney is joining me to talk about his new book, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Thanks for joining me today, Tim.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, Tim, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You're a journalist. You've been at the Washington Examiner for quite a while, and your book actually includes a lot of reporting itself. So there are elements of your journalism career, peppered in there, but you're also a dad. So tell us more about who you are, what inspired you to write this book, because you've written quite a few books. What in the moment inspired you to write this specific book?
So my wife and I, we have six kids. Our oldest is 17, our youngest is 7. And as you said, I'm a journalist. I've gotten to spend the last 25 years going around the country, doing political reporting and looking into cultural trends and that sort of stuff. I'm also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where, we do research. We comb over the data. And I wrote a book 5 years ago called Alienated America, where I argued the most important sort of cultural phenomenon of the last 60 years has been the collapse of local community in the United States. Institutions like church, the neighborhood, a strong public school, a bowling league, as Robert Putnam would put it. And then as I finished that book, I started to realize the most important negative consequence of this was the delay and reduction in family formation. People getting married later and less, people having fewer kids, people wanting fewer kids, but only a little, more people not getting the families that they wanted. And I started thinking about this, and my wife worried that it was going to be me like scolding people for not having six kids. So then I started, and I remember we went for a walk. It was during COVID. We would go for really long walks. We've never been in as good shape as when we had to escape the house. And we were talking, and we started thinking about the ways in which the current culture creates headwinds to family formation, makes it harder. And the way in which families naturally need support from culture, that you can't just have a mom and a dad who are great parents and that's enough to raise kids. The nuclear family is the most important thing. It's necessary. It's not sufficient. And so that's where I came up with the idea of writing a book about how our culture is family unfriendly.
Hey there, listener. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission here at ISI is educating for liberty. If you'd like to join us in fulfilling our mission, consider helping us by rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, to help us reach more listeners like yourself. Now, back to the show.
That's great. And it's something I've been thinking a lot about and talking to some ISI faculty and friends of mine about, especially your book comes out around the same time as Catherine Pokalik's book, Hannah's Children, which is about, and she was on the podcast, I think back in December, to discuss why women. And she also, went out, talked to I think it was 55 plus women, some from totally secular backgrounds, non-religious communities, others, maybe Catholic, Protestant, moms who decided to have, 5+ children. And something that I've personally observed myself from, I go to a traditional Latin Mass parish, so it's very, it's a very active parish with lots of family life and children. And it seems like, although I hear a lot of discussion about remedies that perhaps could come in the form of family policy, but when I talk to friends, it seems like it is a little bit more cultural than just, perhaps having tax deduction or, an extra $1,000 come in the mail for each child or something like that. So is that something that, how does that attitude and that tension between strictly family policy that maybe would be helping to create these vibrant family cultures? Or does it start with something different that is, you know, that is maybe not related to just, you know, receiving a check in the mail?
Policy and economics both interact with culture, but they can't replace it. And so I feel blessed, and it sounds like you're blessed, with a family-friendly subculture that you can live in. We have parishes, we have Catholic schools. I have my wife, we moved to Virginia specifically because that's where her family is. And so I Sunday Mass, we bump into her parents. Sometimes we fill up one entire pew, but sometimes we have to spread throughout two pews because an aunt or an uncle and our kids raise a head and they sit with grandma and grandpa. And that's just a little detail, but you can imagine if you've experienced this, how this rolls out and really creates a supportive environment. Those family-friendly subcultures are the most important thing that people like us have. The broader culture doesn't support a family as much as it can. And one result is that a lot of people who want to raise a family don't have that. I'm very skeptical that most family policy could bring that about. But that said, I do advocate in the book for sort of modest increase in the child tax credit. I talk about the pluses and minuses of things that France does, for instance, where they have a maternity leave that basically becomes a stay-at-home mom benefit. That one actually seems to move the needle on birth rates, for instance. France has a much higher birth rate than any other country in Europe, in part, I argue, because you have a policy that does change the culture. Stay-at-home moms change the culture of a neighborhood. They change the culture of a community. But in general, money doesn't positively change the culture. Some family policy negatively changes the culture. A lot of people in Northern Europe, what they do is they subsidize daycare. That's not a family subsidy. That's a work subsidy. So they have made the culture in places like Sweden more workist. In Sweden, there's actually been a shift in attitude since they started subsidizing childcare there, where people value family less and work more. So it's very easy for government policy to harm the culture. China's one-child policy did that. China's now trying to ramp up to promote more babies, and they're totally failing. So I don't need to get too deep into the role of what the proper role of government should be in promoting family to say it won't have a very big effect compared to what cultural institutions, what civil societies do, what we value, what we talk about.
It does seem like going from zero to one is the tough part. And maybe even for, you know, Zoomers and late millennials now who are settling down, getting married, I'm seeing a lot of focus on this high time preference where I don't think a lot of them are thinking of where they're going to be when they're in their 50s and 70s and how, you know, how children are, it's not just the baby and toddler stage. Did you learn any maybe from your own personal experience with child rearing, but it does seem like that's a non-negligible part of the consideration for a lot of people is, well, you know, we have a good lifestyle thing going on right now. The quality of life is really high. I'm not sure if it's worth the sacrifice. Does your book kind of address some of those? Because there are sacrifices that have to be made, right? Like going from maybe a nice sedan to a van,
a
right?
Minivan, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe getting a bigger house that is a little, you know, in a more suburban environment than a nice, you know, apartment that is close to things that you could walk to, but maybe wouldn't be practical for a stroller, right? So what does your book kind of show us? Maybe there's some reporting that helps us think about that. But how do you kind of tackle that quality of life hurdle that seems to be pretty large?
Well, one study that's famous for saying parents are less happy, it was by this Nobel Prize winning economist named Daniel Kahneman. And he said, the way it gets reported is, you know, three of the activities that bring women the least happiness involve raising kids. And so it asks people, what do you do in the day? And then how would you rank them and how happy they make you? The one that came in below raising kids was work. The ones that came in above, what makes you most happy? It was like watching TV, sex, having hanging out with my friends, drinking, cooking. Everything that ranked above having kids was a diversion. Everything that the only other thing that can really take up your time ranked below raising your kids. And so that's part of the way I try to put it, is that diversions, fun is good. But it was actually talking to a friend of mine whose Spanish was his first language. And he's like, when I hear the word fun, I think of the Spanish word for it, which is, you know, divertido, which a diversion. And so some people will make the distinction between fun and joy, or, you know, fun and satisfaction, happiness and satisfaction. So my argument is that you can't put diversions above actual life callings. And part of the problem with that argument, though, is that it's hard to see that from the other side of the river. This isn't just fun. These are friends. I have deep, meaningful conversations with my buddies, and I'd be giving that up. My weekly poker game, we're talking about philosophy, whatever. It's hard to see from that side of the river what it's like to, you know, wake up to your 2-year-old climbing on top of you and kissing you. Like, it's hard to see what it's like to have people who you have these. I sometimes talk about marriage. I think about the fact that my wife and I have inside jokes that we couldn't possibly explain. Even if somebody wanted to understand them, we couldn't unravel the braided, you know, entangled joke that this is. And so that's where culture comes in. That's why the subtitle of Family Unfriendly is about how our culture makes raising kids harder. What culture does is it aligns your short-term interests and your personal interests with your long-term interests in the common good. It points you towards getting married when you can't rationally see the benefits, but some of it is just expectations. That's what you do. You grow up, you get married, you have kids. Those expectations are set by culture. Our culture currently does not set those expectations. Especially among elites, we sort of try to craft everything is your choice. Because we believe in total autonomy, you should postpone, agonize over, you do your intentional living thing to decide, is this right for me? Am I supposed to get married? When should I get married? When should I have kids? And that choosing makes the whole thing so much a heavier burden. You feel, oh, I have to do it exactly right. It also makes it more of an individualistic burden. You chose this. Marlo, why should I help you raise kids? You're the one who chose this, who made this consumption decision.
So you think it doesn't need to be as hard as it's portrayed in, I think a lot of popular culture is at fault here, but also mm-hmm. I think that the Tiger Mom, which, you know, was, I still see elements of it. I used to tutor students from the time I was in high school up through college in SAT prep and especially writing. And I remember the number of students whose parents seemed way more on them than this. I mean, they were way more motivated. Yeah. I understand, like, I have kids of my own, and you want your kids to succeed. You want to at least have a reasonable expectation that they are going to be safe, have financial security, you know, and that they have a defined enough plan for their lives that you can kind of guide them through, because, you know, having a safety net for your kids is probably an instinct of parents, whether they're children or they're discerning what they want to do after they graduate high school. But I think the Tiger Mom, and I've seen Tiger Moms up close and personal because I used mm-hmm. to tutor their kids. It does seem to, I still see elements of it now, but what, and I, that's certainly not all parents, but even if that's kind of the extreme, I think that even the average parent, the life script, even if it's not get married and have children, the emphasis seems to be on still kind of the standard, go to college for 4 years, wait until at least you're out of college, get a secure job. And then there's arbitrary time period where you kind of, you know, dilly-dally until you're 30 and then you consider settling mm-hmm. down. What do you find in your own experience and in this book that could perhaps lessen the worries of people who want to have kids but think that they need to send them to you know, Montessori or exclusive mm-hmm. schools, Philip Exeter's of schools, who want to, you know, give them the optimal types of childcare and maybe have, you know, they think that they need to have, you know, eyes on them at all times.
I push back on. Chapter one is called "Have Lower Ambitions for Your Kids," and that's sort of a joke, right? Because I want my kids to be men and women of virtue. I want them to be saints. I'm a Catholic. I want them to share in God's glory for eternity. So that's the highest ambition possible. But if they never make the varsity baseball team, and if they don't get into Princeton, that I won't have been a failure as a parent. And similarly, there's this illusion of control that we can protect our kids from any harm, which is, it's false. It's a lie. It leads us to give our kids less freedom and make their childhood less happy. And psychiatrists are now starting to say the lack of independent play for children is bad for them. And so some of my arguments are on just try to argue on the terms of the would-be over ambitious parents or the helicopter parents and say, it doesn't work. Your kid is not going to have a higher opinion of his own athletic ability if he specializes in baseball. It's actually going to make him have a lower understanding because he's going to get to some travel tournament where he's like, there are 30 better pitchers just in this tournament than I am, despite the fact that I've spent all my life on. It's not going to work because it's going to cause him to be more anxious. And you can't actually protect your kid from every harm. And you create new harms by trying to do that. So that's sort of arguing on the term on those worldly terms, but then try to expand it and say what you should want for your kids is something much more important than these things. And, you know, that's a tougher argument. I say that for the later chapters in the book, but I think that those tougher arguments are important to consider because I think helicopter parenting and overambitious parenting is culturally downstream from our secularization, our increasing materialism, our increasing just worship of autonomy as a new God. Because I think that our view of the person then becomes instrumental. Well, are you a good person? It depends on what you accomplish. It depends on what you achieve. So that's why I do think, even though I'm writing a book for a secular audience, I do think I have to get to the anthropology, the understanding of the human individual, to pull people away from this idea of the measurable success is the only thing that counts.
And how did you approach writing this for a secular audience? Because I was thinking and talking about this with my husband the other day, and we were talking about kind of our child rearing philosophy, and we're both Catholics, so the faith is central to our lives. And like you said, for your own kids, the ultimate desire is we want to be raising saints. And if any, you know, for especially for Catholics, we want to our ultimate goal as parents is to make sure that our kids receive the sacraments and that they are right by God and that they're practicing the faith. And especially developing those habits early on in childhood. But how do you communicate things like virtue and piety to a secular audience of, and I'm sure, you know, unchurched nuns, mm-hmm. people who may be dismissive of those aspects of child rearing, or perhaps they're fallen away from their faith. And so it might not seem, you know, relevant to them because it seems like it's just two different, you know, lifestyle and child rearing philosophies that exist totally separately.
Yes. So you try to gently build up an argument. Now you're asking me sort of a writing question, and I'm glad because I spent a lot of time thinking about and changing the order of the book. And I didn't originally start with travel sports, but now it starts with, you know, the preface is a T-ball league that's based around just parents ignoring the kids and bringing the whole family and everybody runs around. So this very accessible, material, quotidian freedom that parents need. And then travel baseball is in chapter one. Stress-filled. If there are bad guys in the book, the first one is my son's travel baseball coach, who says baseball isn't fun, winning is fun. And so the stress of that the anxiety, how it backfires, and then helicoptering, how that makes parenting difficult, and build up to trickier, weightier things. But early on, plant the seed of talk about my relative is this girl with Down syndrome, and when she does dance class, it's the highlight of the performance for everybody else. Her rhythm is not A+, but her joy of this just infects absolutely everybody. And my nephew John Paul, who he died before his second birthday, he had spinal muscular atrophy, and just when you see the value in that sort of life, it becomes impossible to cling totally to a materialistic, utilitarian understanding of the person. And so planting those seeds and then building up and saying, it's our anthropology that has a problem, our view of the human person that has a problem. And the idea of virtue, I don't think, is inaccessible for sort of the modern secular mind, because we think about self-sacrifice all the time. If you've ever dieted or exercised, you engage in giving up something for a greater good, trying to become a better person. And anybody who has strong friendships, or who's married, or who has a kid, or who has a good relationship with their parents, they can understand, okay, wait a second, I do actually see the human individual as nested in, as defined by our relationships, and not just this free-floating bundle of rights. It's only when we abstract from our own life that we end up with this sort of modern spirit of, you know, Rousseau, and I'm not going to let another person define who I am. And so will I lose readers along the way? Yes, but sort of slowly walk them towards a better understanding, because I think the Judeo-Christian anthropology is the right one. If you tell the story well enough, that echoes out of understanding who the human person is. And so that idea of saying, if you want a life of virtue, parenting is going to be the easiest path. That's the argument I make in the last chapter. And we'll see. The book is brand new. We'll see if I bring along the secular readers. But that was definitely my aim.
And I have to ask, because obviously I'm sure your wife had some sort of influence in obviously your personal life. But what about your book? What was her role in helping you design the thesis and maybe some of the other aspects of it?
So she warned me away from it sounding finger waggy and nagging. And she was definitely the one who helped me come up with how to make it be immediately accessible. And what are the sort of things you can say that make the reader say, okay, yes, that's me. That's what I'm going through. And one of the central chapters is on stay-at-home moms. And Katie's a stay-at-home mom. So the sentence I have in there, and this is not going to be in most of the books you read about, you know, parenting culture in the U.S., but I say, America needs more stay-at-home moms like Katie. And so her example of how she, you know, what she contributes to her friendship circles, to our schools, et cetera, by being available in these hours is immense. And that example, but also there was this one moment where I escaped from my family. I got asked to like come do a fellowship in Massachusetts. And so I went away for like 4 days to work on the book. And as I was in a bar in the Berkshires writing this book, the people sitting next to me, this one woman was a psychiatrist. And when she found out what I was writing about, she turned into like a therapy session to make me feel bad about my life. And says, "You," and I said, I'm a good husband. I'm a good dad. Like I bring my wife coffee in bed every morning, and she gets these getaways with her sisters. And the woman said, "But does she get to get away to finish her book like you do?" And so I immediately called Katie in the morning. I was like, is our marriage this unequal? And she said, "Tim, do you remember when my sister had twins and I just disappeared? Do you remember when, you know, our friends had these struggles and I just said, you're making dinner, you're in charge, and I'm going to go off and go for a walk or get a drink with whomever?" And made me realize that her second job, if my second job is writing a book, and her second job was being that indispensable friend and sister, And that was a way of understanding domestic life and that kind of thing that I had I never would have understood without her making that argument to me.
Yeah, it's something that I've seen a lot of interest in discussing stay-at-home motherhood in a little bit less of a basically what I've been seeing on places like TikTok, but Twitter is there seems to be like, by no means mean to make this seem like it's a large, you know, larger scale phenomenon than it actually is. But I do see kind of a renewed interest in it just because I think a lot of women are realizing like we aren't meant to be doing a lot of, we're not meant to have feet in both worlds at the same time, just because we are specialized creatures and we also have finite time to do these mm-hmm. things. If you do have children, being able to take care of them while also working is sometimes, it's for a very privileged class of women. It is possible. Like, for example, I work from home. So in some cases, you know, the work from home revolution has been a boon to many working mothers who are able to also have more face time with their kids. But have you seen any, you know, as a journalist who has their finger on the pulse here, have you seen personally as a woman, I see stay-at-home motherhood, especially among, it sounds like this was kind of, you know, a ivory tower academic type, mm-hmm. you know, psychiatrist, psychologist who maybe read a lot of Judith Butler. but is that something that you think is a dying out breed of criticism about the life of the domestic arts of, you know, a mom who stays at home with her children? Or
I think we have a totally dysfunctional and stupid conversation around this more broadly. That's one of the things I'm hoping to accomplish with Family Unfriendly is to talk intelligently about it, because the term tradwife has broadened and lost some of its meaning. It's now this sort of amorphous blob, and some people use it to describe these momfluencers who portray this picture of, because I stay at home, I can make from scratch cornflakes for my kids for breakfast and grilled cheese sandwiches for lunch while being basically a model, and that is the alternative to working 40 hours a week is one of the stupidest parts of our conversation. Another stupid part is that I think if you pull, I know because I've got the data in the book, when you pull the public, first of all, pull all parents, what is the optimal arrangement? Two-thirds of them say one or both parents sacrificing hours of work to be home. Mothers, particularly working class mothers, say the best arrangement is a basically a full-time mom, a stay-at-home mom. Not all of them. If all American mothers got to snap their fingers, excuse me, and have the work arrangement they want, a lot of it would be yours. Work from home. And then when their kids, especially when their kids go off to school, work from home and be there when the school bus drops off at 3 p.m. or be there to pick up the kids. So, but if you were to poll the news media in the United States, I think you'd find 5% at most think that the idea of stay-at-home moms is good. This over-ambitious workist class in the U.S. that controls so much of the conversation is so averse to the idea of a stay-at-home mom. And by the way, in the book, I say stay-at-home dads. We need more of those too. But honestly, if we had more stay-at-home parents, 90% of them, at least 80% of them, would be women. But that idea that the country would benefit from more stay-at-home moms is anathema to our tastemakers, but it still makes sense to a majority of Americans.
And what are the fruits of that vocation as a stay-at-home mother? I'm sure you've probably seen them in your own life. Perhaps your book also addresses them. But I think this is especially important because I oversee our programming at ISI, and I constantly I observe kind of some tension between the men and women in some of our seminars when we address topics related to gender and also, you know, female versus male vocation. And it does seem like there is sometimes a misunderstanding of just how much fruit, you know, and, mm-hmm. and just how much it enriches the lives of not only the children, but also the woman and the family whenever a woman isn't able to stay at home. And obviously there are sacrifices that need to be made. Something I hear a lot of is, well, no one can survive on a single income anymore. And I think in some cases that's certainly true, but I think it's people are missing that, you know, often that it does require a lot of sacrifice. We talked about, you know, switching the nice sedan for a used minivan, using hand-me-downs for each child that you have. But where do you fall in that whenever you're discussing this in the book?
So first of all, I mean, the first part of your question on the benefits of more stay-at-home parents, Emma Green is a writer at The Atlantic, and she wrote an article that I cite in Family Unfriendly about how much of civic leadership and volunteerism and just erecting of civil society was done by married mothers who didn't have paid jobs outside the home. And so as their kids got older, what they did with their time was they built and propped up institutions of civil society. And this obviously happens today. I mean, there's a reason we have a term PTA mom instead of PTA dad, and they still exist. But that collapse of civil society that, you know, we've been talking about, Robert Putnam, Charles Murray, my last book, Alienated America, a lot of that is due, this Emma Green argues in her piece, to the fact that married couples mostly increasingly have two working parents who are working 40 hours a week outside the home. And so that's part of what's lost. On the economics, yes, it is harder today for a man to be a breadwinner than it was 60 years ago. And in fact, Elizabeth Warren, when she was an academic, wrote a book called The Two-Income Trap. And part of it is that the larger labor force, with most married women working, bids down the price of labor some, and then there's not as much of a leeway. It used to be that if the man gets disabled or dies, the woman actually could jump in and take on a job, and suddenly that's new income. But now if you're relying on both income, there's no sub to jump into the labor force. And it's harder. Anyway, so then the economics, though, doesn't explain, if you look at broadly at why people not doing more family formation, economics is part of it, but I walk through the data and show how it can't really explain the falling birth rates, because millennials aren't, in fact, poorer than Gen X was. One piece of data I point to from economist Jeremy Horpital is that if you just look at the hours of work required, or the weeks of work required to pay for the estimated cost of raising a child, the annual cost of having a child, the median man, so if you just look at the median male worker, the amount of weeks he has to work to do that has gone down since 2010. So, while the birth rate has also gone down. So it's actually become more affordable for a single male over age 25 working to afford a kid, but at the same time, the number of babies going down. So economics clearly deters some families, especially the cost of affording a home, which in the last 3 years has skyrocketed. But the baby bust started 15 years ago. So economics is an incomplete account.
Now, we have so much left to discuss, but we're running out of time. So I would just like to hear about was there something that was very surprising to you while you were working on this book? Anything that you think might surprise readers or people who maybe are in the know who might pick up your book? And maybe this is from, you know, personal anecdote or reporting that you did.
So one thing was that secular Jews in Israel have a very high birth rate, lower than religious Jews, but 2.0 is their total fertility rate. The U.S. is 1.6, 1.7. Europe is 1.5. France, which I spoke about earlier, is 1.9. So secular Jews as a population are more fertile, have more babies than any country in Europe. That is what really surprised me, because I thought about how religion interacted with the embrace of family, and it surprised me that it trickled out into the broader community. And I learned this at about the time that a demographer in Utah told me, the Catholics in America who have the most babies are the Catholics in Utah. And so the way I put it is, I didn't realize that pregnancy spread through the air, that it was contagious. But it does. And that points to something that didn't surprise me, but how culture is what, including subcultures and local cultures, is what supports family formation. And that that culture is so powerful that it affects people who are outside of the faith that's setting that culture.
It's great. Well, I really appreciate all of your commentary today, Tim. Very much so looking forward to reading the book and also some of the reviews and getting the word out about it. So where can people order the book? I take it Amazon, anywhere else that books are sold.
Yep, it's on sale now. Hopefully at your local bookstore, walk in there, pick it up, scream, "Family Unfriendly, this looks like an amazing book," and then buy it. And yes, and it's available for order on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Marla.
Thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our website at isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, debates, lectures, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.